Chapter 15. The dark, tepid Pacific water closed over Pitt's head. He momentarily allowed his body to go limp in the weightless dimension of the sea. The circular beam from his dive light illuminated the diver 20 feet below, who was looking over his shoulder to see if Pitt was trailing his kicking fins. It suddenly occurred to Pitt that being last man in line might be dangerous. The suffocating blackness plunged him into a profound sense of anxiety. He was certain that every type of predator imaginable was sneaking into position for a quick bite of his legs. Every few seconds he spun around, flashing the light in all directions, but met no monsters of the night. The only odd-looking creature in his field of vision was his fellow human swimming unconcerned below. Pitt's apprehension eased somewhat when the bottom loomed up through his face mask. For all he knew, he might have been swimming upside down. The rocks took on morbid shapes with ghost-like faces, but they seemed like old friends when he reached down and touched their coarse, solid features. A nervous squid, the first sign of sea life, dashed across his narrow angle of sight and vanished. Then the rock formations tapered away and the seafloor became sandy. Pitt's adrenaline surged through his body as a huge black shape rose up under the swaying concert of light beams. The Starbuck lay just as he'd left her, looking like a great spectral monster in the blackness. Kicking his fins, Pitt swam past the Navy men to the head of the line and, grasping Giordino by the arm, peered into his friend's face mask. The face inside was softly distorted by the dive light, but Giordino's eyes were bright, and in spite of the mouthpiece, his grin was clear and distinct as he gave a thumbs-up sign. Pitt wrote some words on his message board, motioned to Crowhaven, and held it up. "This is where we get off. She's all yours." Crowhaven nodded, his blonde hair drifting in loose strands. He quickly began distributing his men. 4 submariners and 1 SEAL were to enter through the flooded forward torpedo compartment and close the vents and valves left open by the Martha Ann's divers. The rest of the men were to drop through the aft escape chamber into the dry section of the submarine and make their way to the control room. The submariners' fear had left them now. The time had come for them to rely on their own skills and experience. The men forward entered in one group, but the crew aft had to divide into 3 shifts due to the chamber's compact interior. Pitt closed the hatch after the last 5 men dropped into the sub and waited until he felt the surge from the exhaust vents as the water was expelled from inside the escape compartment. Then he pounded the butt of his knife against the hull 3 times. Almost immediately, 3 muffled knocks came from inside, signaling no problem so far. Pitt swam along the narrow top deck to the bow, where he repeated his poundings. The reply came back much slower this time, with more of a muted sound, due to the acoustics of the flooded torpedo room. Pitt wrote again on the board. "Entrance around somewhere. 18 minutes. Giordino understood. 18 minutes of air. That's all the time they would have to search for the entrance to the seamount. Pitt tapped him on the shoulder and darted off to the right. Giordino followed Pitt's slithering form as they silently glided over the eerie seascape, bound together by the fragile glow of their lights. They didn't bother memorizing landmarks. Instead, they placed their trust in the compass strapped to Pitt's left wrist as the only means of rediscovering the Starbuck before their air ran out. Their first encounter was with another victim of the vortex, slowly materializing in the twin shafts of their lights. The plates on the side of the hull were smooth and clean, and there was no sign of weed growth. It was a fresh wreck. Pitt was at a loss. He had studied the list of missing ships, and except for the Starbuck, no new disappearance had been reported in the last 6 months. How could a ship this size vanish without being reported overdue in port? She was sitting upright as though she were still floating on the surface, refusing to concede her fate. They swam past the deserted decks and saw that she had once been a trawler, a large one. A pity, Pitt thought. She was certainly a fine ship. The bulwarks gleamed and the superstructure fairly bristled with the latest design in electronic scanners and antennae. So far, there was no sign of Delphi's men, but just to be on the safe side, Pitt gestured for Giordino to stand watch while he searched the bridge. Giordino waved a hand in acknowledgement, stationing himself at a bulkhead below the starboard bridge wing, where he switched off his light and instantly melted into the black depths. Pitt snaked through the open door of the wheelhouse and into its ominous, crypt-like interior. He shined his light about, rooted to the spot by the strange surroundings. His eye caught an ugly, transparent snake that wiggled across the ceiling and dissolved into an open vent. Then another long reptilian form that slithered into a ceiling corner and then slowly meandered into the vent. The snakes were streams of his own exhaust bubbles that had risen to the top of the cabin before discovering an escape route to the surface. Pitt didn't know what he expected to discover in the ship, but what he found gave him nightmares for many years to come. The charts, folding back and forth from the current, lay on the table, still firm to the touch as though they had been immersed just the day before. The spokes of the wheel were thrown out in a pathetic circle of despair, as if knowing that no hands would ever grip their contour again. The brass on the binnacle gleamed in the faint light, and the compass needle still faithfully pointed toward some forgotten course, while the arrows on the telegraph were settled forever on the all-stop position. Pitt bent closer. Something was out of kilter. The letters beneath the signal lever weren't printed in English. He studied them intently for a moment and then swam back to the binnacle, aiming his light at the nameplate screwed flush above the compass opening. His knowledge of the Russian language consisted of less than 20 words, but he could make out enough of the backward alphabet to decipher the ship's name, Andrei Viborg. So the Russian spy trawler had found the Starbuck, Pitt reflected, only to die and rest beside her, courtesy of Delphi and his pirates. Pitt didn't have time to reflect further. Just then something touched him on the back of his shoulder. Pitt spun around, beaming his light into the face of a man. It was a face that was frighteningly unnatural and twisted with an ungodly expression. The white blur of teeth shone through a mouth that was agape, and he stared unblinkingly out of one eye. The other eye was hidden by a small crab that had eaten itself halfway into the socket. The man swayed and motioned like a drunken scarecrow, his arms lifting and falling as if beckoning under the silent, unrelenting force of the current. The terrifying wraith hovered 4 feet from the deck and moved against Pitt, who was rooted to the spot, frozen immobile at the sight. Pitt savagely shoved the dead body away, watching it float toward the inner doorway of the wheelhouse where it dissolved into the curtain of black beyond. There was nothing more to be seen or accomplished on the Soviet trawler. It was time to get the hell out. There were only a few minutes left before he and Giordino would be on their reserve air. Giordino was still standing his vigil under the bridge wing when he heard the sound waves off in the distance. He swam up to the wheelhouse and motioned for Pitt, who was just exiting, to douse his light. Pitt complied. They both crouched below the port window, listening to the approaching whir of an electric motor several seconds before the dim glow of a light came into view. At first it looked like a strange primeval creature, but as it neared, they could see that it was an underwater craft designed like a porpoise with a horizontal fluke on the tail for control. Two figures sat astride the sleek mini-sub, the man in the front saddle steering, while his partner navigated from behind. A small propeller churned the water behind the rear stabilizer and pushed the two men through the depths at a pace of about 5 knots. The craft and its passengers were headed directly toward the bridge of the Andrei Viborg. Pitt and Giordino pressed their bodies against the bulkhead beneath the window. It was too late to contain their breathing. They could do nothing but watch helplessly as their bubbles floated upward into the path of the sub. In a synchronized movement, they each unsheathed their knives and waited for the inevitable confrontation. The twin streams from their exhaust air were bound to give their presence away. The sub veered around the forward mast and approached the wheelhouse. It was so close now that Pitt could distinctly make out the small breathing units attached to the crew's chests. His grip on the knife tightened. He braced his body to spring through the doorway, hoping to get in the first thrust, knowing his small blade was no match for the projectile guns. The moment of suspense ended. At the last possible instant, the sub's bow tilted sharply upward, passing through the bubbles and disappearing over the bridge. The sound of the motor slowly diminished. Almost immediately, its light was lost to sight, and seconds later, the last beat of the propeller died away. Giordino switched on his light, and Pitt could see him shrug his shoulders in a questioning, baffled gesture. Then it slowly dawned on Pitt. The Andrei Viborg had not yet belched all of her air pockets. Everywhere along the hull and superstructure, small trails of air and oil mingled and rose in lazy spurts to the ocean's surface. Delphi's men had simply ignored all signs of bubbles, knowing that a sunken ship takes months, sometimes years, to expel its trapped air. Pitt tapped his watch and pointed in the direction of the retreating mini-sub. Giordino nodded, and together they swam over the ship's railing and dropped down to the seafloor, taking advantage of its grotesquely shaped rocks and vegetation for cover. As the dark hulk of the Andrei Viborg receded behind them, Pitt threw her a last look over his shoulder. The Americans now knew the location of her grave, but the Russians, he was certain, would never be told where to find her. Pitt's depth gauge readings began rising. He led Giordino up a slope on the seamount. The water was cold, far colder than it should have been for this part of the Pacific. Their eyes strained the length of their light's rays, searching the bottom for signs of activity. But evidence that would betray the geometrical straight lines of human manufacture failed to materialize. There had to be an opening, Pitt thought. The mini-sub must have come from somewhere. They were past their time limit now. There was no chance of making it back to the safety of the Starbuck. They had no choice but to keep going until the air in the main tanks was nearly exhausted and then head for the surface in the impossible hope they might somehow be picked up before the concussion from the monitor's missile crushed their bodies to pulp. Suddenly, Pitt noticed a change in the water temperature. It had become warmer, perhaps by as much as 5 degrees. At the same moment, a powerful current rolled across the slope, sweeping the sand into small swirling clouds, stretching the weed growth on a wavering horizontal plane. The sudden surge of the current thrust its invisible mass against the two men, thrusting them over the seafloor like ping-pong balls in a hurricane. The vicious flow swept both men through a thrashing forest of seaweed, the fronds flaying their faces, leaving red lash marks across their cheeks and foreheads. Pitt somersaulted and collided with a huge outcropping of rock that was coated with a thick blanket of marine growth. The green slime rubbed off in his hands, and the sharp edges from a colony of shell creatures sliced into his rubber wetsuit. He was pinned against the rocks for an instant, and then the unpredictable whim of the current jerked him back into its path. He felt something grasp his leg. It was Giordino's arm, circled around Pitt's thigh just under the crotch, holding on with all the force of a hydraulic vice. Pitt looked into Giordino's face mask, and he could have sworn he saw one brown eye wink. The added weight of their combined bodies was already reducing the drag from the current, and, more important, Giordino's grip would keep them from becoming separated during their swirling journey through the tempest of exploding sand and seaweed. Pitt became aware of a dull clanking noise, an odd tolling sound coming from his air tanks smashing against the rocks. He tumbled on his back for a fleeting moment and shined his light upward, briefly watching the surface shimmer back in the reflection. He reached out as if to touch it and then realized that his mind was wandering. He jerked his senses back to the moment, just in time to throw up his arm and shield his face before ramming a massive barnacle-coated boulder. What rescued him in those first jarring seconds was the quarter-inch rubber thickness of his wetsuit. But it wasn't enough to save him completely. The barbed growth cut past the rubber and nylon inner lining. Pitt was stabbed with pain as the water around his arm burst into a cloud of his blood. His face mask was ripped away, and the swirling sand invaded his eyes and nostrils, scouring the delicate membranes. He tried to exhale through his nose to clear the sand, but only succeeded in adding to the irritation. His eyes stung from the combined attack of sand and salt water. The sudden closure of the lids threw his brain into spinning blackness. Then his head slammed into a low rock, and a skyrocket soared and burst into a brilliant rainbow of color, sputtered out, and all was still. Giordino felt Pitt's body go limp and collapse. The dive light dropped from an open hand and fell to the bottom. Giordino shone his own light into Pitt's face, perceiving the loss of consciousness. He satisfied himself that Pitt's mouthpiece was still secured between the teeth, and then tightened his stubby arms around Pitt's leg and continued hanging on. A stretch of sandy gravel passed under Giordino. He lashed out with his feet, desperately attempting to drag them as a brake. Both his fins were torn away, and the skin flayed from his feet and ankles. He clenched his teeth on the mouthpiece of his air hose until the rubber split, and dug his bleeding feet deeper into the sand. It was a move born of desperation, and it failed. His feet merely gouged two grooves in the yielding sea bottom before losing their hold and breaking loose. Suddenly, like a cat who tires of a mouse, the treacherous undercurrent spun them out of its mainstream and released them. Giordino quickly reached out and grabbed a handful of seagrass, pulling his unconscious burden toward a small crater-like pocket on the bottom. Then he relaxed and drifted downward in the calm water, letting Pitt sink gently beside him. It was quiet in the operations bunker at Pearl Harbor. The typewriters were mute. The computers sat silent and inoperative, their tape reels staring like great round, unlidded eyes. Half the staff was grouped around the radio center, the men thoughtfully smoking and saying nothing, the women nervously pouring coffee, looking pale and drawn. The tenseness in the atmosphere lay heavily and drained everyone's energies. Hunter and Denver sat on either side of the radio operator, looking at each other through tired, bloodshot eyes. Denver pulled a small plastic vial from his breast pocket and idly toyed with it, rolling it back and forth on the table. Hunter studied him for a moment and then raised his eyebrows questioningly. "What's that thing?" Denver held it up. "Pitt gave it to me to have analyzed. It was originally in a hypodermic syringe." "Pitt gave it to you?" Hunter persisted. "What's in it?"
DG-10,
Denver said briefly. "One of the deadliest poisons around. Extremely difficult to detect. The body has all the appearances of a heart seizure."
"What was he doing with it?"
Denver shrugged. "I don't know. He was very sly about it. Said we'd know in the end." Hunter's eyes were remote, unseeing.
"An enigma. That man's a don't-give-a-damn enigma."
"Telephone, Admiral." Hunter was interrupted by an officer who held out a receiver.
"Who is it?"
The officer looked lost for a moment, then hesitantly said,
"It's Aloha Willie, the late-night disc jockey on radio station Popo."
Hunter's mouth dropped.
"What is this, mister? I don't want to talk to any damn disc jockey. How did he get on our private lines anyway?"
The officer looked extremely ill at ease.
"He said it was urgent, sir.
His contest riddle is, the blackbird has come home to nest. He said you'd win a prize if you knew the answer."
"What nonsense is this?" Hunter fairly exploded. "You tell that nut to..."
Suddenly Hunter's lips froze and his eyes widened.
"My God, Crowhaven!"
He snatched the receiver and talked rapidly with the voice on the other end of the line. Then he thrust the receiver back at the stunned officer and turned to Denver.
"Crowhaven is sending over the frequency of a Honolulu radio station."
Denver's expression was one of abject bewilderment.
"I don't understand." "It's brilliant, positively brilliant," Hunter said excitedly. "Delphi would never think to monitor the frequency of a commercial broadcast station, especially a rock and roll program. Nobody but a handful of kids would be tuned in at this time of the morning."
He leaned over the radio operator. "Set your frequency to 1250. At first, the concrete walls were greeted by a loud blast of music which assaulted the eardrums of everyone in the bunker. Then, before the confused staff crowded around the radio fully absorbed the shock, a high-pitched voice that spit words like a machine gun broke through the speaker.
"Hi-ho there, you early morning bird watchers! This is Aloha Willie with the top 40 tunes rocking your way across the tropical airwaves with some really great sounds for you discounts. Time now, 3:50. Okay, are you ready, group? Glue your ears to the transistors and listen now as we play the flip side of the latest comedy record by Big Daddy and his gang. Take it away, Big Daddy."
The radio operator in the bunker pushed the transmit button and cut in on the program. "Big Daddy calling our gang. Come in, please. Over."
"This is our gang, Big Daddy. Do you read? Over."
Denver leapt to his feet.
"That's Crowhaven. He's done it. He's calling from inside the Starbuck."
"We read you, our gang. Over." "Here is the final score. Visitors, 1 run, 1 hit, 3 errors. Home team, 0 runs, 3 hits, 4 errors. Hunter gazed emptily at the speaker.
"The code for casualties.
Crowhaven has taken control of the submarine, but it cost him 1 dead and 3 wounded.
"We acknowledge the score, our gang," droned the radio man. "Our congratulations to the visiting team for their win. When can they leave the ballpark?"
The reply came back without hesitation.
"The showers are steaming and the locker room should be emptied in another hour. We'll load bus and leave stadium by 0400.
Denver rapped the table with his fist and a big smile widened across his cherubic face. "The reactors are generating steam to the turbines and they'll have the forward torpedo compartment pumped dry in an hour. Thank God they're ahead of schedule."
Hunter reached over and took the microphone from the operator. "Our gang, this is Big Daddy. Where is the kid?"
"The kid and his sidekick went over the hill in search of a lost gold mine. No word since then. Assume they became lost in the desert and ran out of water."
Hunter silently set down the microphone. There was no need to translate. The message was all too clear.
"We'll bring you up to date on the sports at 0500, Crowhaven's voice continued. "Our gang out." Aloha Willie cut back in without missing a beat.
"There you have it, group. Now for number 12 on the charts. Avery Anson Pence singing The Great Bikini Ripoff."
The radio operator switched off the speaker.
"That's it, sir, until 0500. Admiral Hunter moved slowly away and sank in a chair. He stared dully at the wall.
"A high price to pay," Hunter said softly.
"Pitt should have stayed with Crowhaven," Denver said bitterly. "He should have never gone off in search of your daughter."
Denver caught himself too late. Hunter looked up. "I did not give Pitt permission to look for Adrian."
"I know, sir," Denver shrugged helplessly.
I tried to discourage him, but he insisted on making the attempt. He does what he wants to do.
Did what he wanted to do, Hunter said hopelessly, his voice trailing off softly.
Welcome back to the land of the walking dead. Pitt slowly focused his eyes and looked up into the ever-grinning face of Giordino.
Who's walking? Pitt muttered.
He wished he were unconscious again, wished the burning ache in his gashed arm and the throb from his bruised head belonged to someone else. He didn't move. He just lay there and soaked up the sea of pain.
For a while there, I thought you'd need a casket, Giordino said casually.
He held out his hand and Giordino pulled him to a sitting position. Pitt blinked his eyes to remove the sand and salt water.
Where in hell are we?
An underwater cave, Giordino answered. I found it right after you blacked out and we escaped from that god-awful current. Pitt looked around the small chamber, lit dimly by Giordino's dented dive light. It was about 20 feet wide and 30 feet long, and the ceiling was between 5 and 10 feet high. 3/4 of the floor was water, while the remainder consisted of the rocky shelf that he and Giordino rested on. The walls of the semi-flooded gallery were smooth and covered by a score of tiny crabs that scooted about the ledge like frightened ants.
I wonder how deep we are, Pitt murmured.
My depth gauge read 80 feet outside the entrance. Pitt longed for a cigarette. He dragged his sore body across the shelf to one wall and leaned against it, staring in dumb fascination at the blood that splotched his black rubber wetsuit.
A pity I don't have a camera, said Giordino. You'd make a great human interest story.
Looks worse than it really is, Pitt lied. He nodded at Giordino's feet.
I'm sorry I can't say the same about your bug crushers.
Yeah, I don't think any of my piggies will be going to market for a while. Giordino coughed up mucus and spat it in the water.
Now what?
We can't go back outside, Pitt said thoughtfully. With all this blood, we'd draw every shark within 10 miles. He paused, glanced at his watch, and then stared at the water.
We've got nearly 2 hours before the monitor cuts loose. What say we spend it looking around?
Giordino's expression was devoid of enthusiasm.
We're hardly in prime condition to go exploring caves.
You know how easily I get bored sitting around.
Giordino wearily shook his head. The things I do for a friend.
He took careful aim at a crab, spat, and missed.
I guess anything beats an evening with these guys. What's the status of our equipment?
I'd hoped you wouldn't ask, Giordino said. All in about the same shape I'm in. Except for our air tanks, which are, if you'll pardon the expression, on their last gasp, we have exactly one face mask, 40 feet of nylon line, one flipper, and this light, which has just about had it.
Forget the air tanks. I'll try a free dive first.
Pitt slipped the fin on a foot and took the nylon cord, wrapping one end around his waist. You rest easy and hold on to the other end of the line. When you feel 3 jerks, get out of there fast. 2 jerks, pull like hell. 1 jerk, follow me in.
It'll be lonesome here, Giordino sighed, just me and the crabs.
Pitt grinned. You won't be lonely long. Pitt picked up the light and sat on the edge of the shelf. He inhaled and exhaled several times, hyperventilating to purge the carbon dioxide from his system. Finally, satisfied that his lungs could hold no more, he slid into the gloomy water and stroked toward the bottom of the cavern. Pitt was an excellent diver. He could stay underwater, holding his breath for nearly 2 minutes. His muscles ached and the bloody cuts in his skin smarted from the salt water, but he plunged downward with one hand touching the smooth surface of the wall, while the other gripped and aimed the light. The wall sloped on a broken angle for 15 feet and then leveled out into a confining shaft. Pitt came to a mound of fallen rock that nearly blocked his forward progress, but he managed to snake over the obstacle and found that the walls began expanding away from his line of vision. He pulled his body through into the new chamber and made a gliding ascent, slowly waving the one flipper. In a matter of seconds, he popped into sweet air and a gallery that was flooded by a soft yellow glow. It was a golden world, a world of yellow where even the shadows were cast in matching hues. The roof was at least 20 feet high and glistened with a mass of tiny stalactites which trickled water in small splashing drops throughout the interior.
Pitt breaststroked through the gold-tinted water to a rock-carved grand stairway, which stretched into a long curving tunnel with odd-looking triangular grooved notches embedded in the steps. Two effigies of square-bearded men with fishtails instead of legs crouched in a sphinx-like fashion on each side of the landing. The statues were deeply eroded from the dripping water and appeared to be extremely old. He hoisted his buttocks onto the bottom step of the landing and removed his mask, blinking his eyes to adjust to the eerie strangeness of the light. The tightness of the wetsuit began to irritate his arm. Tenderly, favoring the gashes on his arm, he managed to slip it from his body. When he unwrapped the nylon cord from around his waist, he noticed a scant 3 feet of slack. He gave the cord one sharp tug, and as soon as it became taut, he hauled it in hand over hand until Giordino's curly head popped to the surface. "I've gone to a yellow hell," Giordino sputtered. He pushed the hair out of his eyes and extended his hand to Pitt. "Welcome to Delphi's House of Horrors." He grabbed Giordino's hand and hauled him from the water onto the step. Giordino nodded toward the sculptures. "The local reception committee?" He rubbed a hand over one of the squared-off beards, stroking the stony surface. "Any idea what causes the weird light?" "It seems to emanate from the rocks." "That it does," Giordino agreed. "Take a look at my hand." He held up his palm and the skin emitted a faint glow. "I can't give you a chemical analysis of the mineral content, but I'm reasonably certain it contains a healthy dose of phosphorescence." "I've never known it to be quite this bright," Pitt said. Giordino sniffed the air. "I smell eucalyptus." "Eucalyptus oil. They use it to lower the humidity and keep the air from getting stale." Giordino began peeling off his own wetsuit, gently easing it over his injured feet. They were, Pitt discerned in the strange light, torn nearly to the bone and were soon surrounded in a spreading pool of blood. But, he thought, he could still walk easily enough. "I'm going to scout the stairway. Why don't you hang around and enjoy the sights?" "No chance," Giordino smiled gamely. "I think it wiser if we stuck together. I'll keep up. Just mind the road ahead." Pitt squinted at Giordino's bleeding body and then looked down at his own. "We're certainly a sorry-looking invasion force," he thought. They were both hurt badly. "Okay, tough guy, but don't play silent hero." Pitt knew his words were useless. Giordino would follow until he passed out. Without waiting for a comment, he turned and began walking up the stairway. They climbed with agonizing slowness amid the unreal surroundings into a winding tunnel. The only sounds came from their labored breathing and the constant splatter of water trickling from the ceiling. The tunnel gradually narrowed until it was slightly over 5 feet high and 3 feet wide. The steps suddenly shortened until they became a smooth ramp. Pitt kept his back pressed against the damp surface of the wall and stooped to keep from hitting his head while inching his way through the passage. The batteries of the dive light were almost dead, and the beam they projected through the lens barely cast more illumination than the phosphorescence. Every 30 feet he paused and waited for Giordino to hobble painfully within arm's length. Pitt noted that each time he halted, Giordino took a little longer to catch up. It was becoming increasingly apparent to him that Giordino couldn't last much longer. "Next time, find a cave with escalators," Giordino panted. It took him 3 breaths to get the words out through clenched teeth. "A little workout never hurt anybody," Pitt said. He had to keep Giordino going now. If they didn't find a way to the surface above the seamount, they would die a lonely death, crushed under thousands of tons of rocks and water. Pitt pushed on. The dive light was down to a faint glow, and he simply, uncaringly let it slip from his hand to the rock floor. He hesitated a moment, staring unconcernedly at the light as it rolled down the tunnel in the direction he had climbed. He vacantly wondered what Giordino would think when it came rattling by. Pitt's goose flesh rose in unison with a sudden cold air current that danced across his skin. There had to be a vent or an opening ahead. Soon a gentle, textured blue film met his eyes. The blue seemed to waver and alternate in tones that cast soft, animate shadows on the passage walls. Pitt moved closer. The thing swirled with a movement that was familiar. "Why can't I recognize it?" he dazedly wondered. His brain was fogging. Fatigue rushed through his veins and deadened all his thought processes. He stopped and waited for Giordino, but Giordino did not come. Pitt couldn't combat his feelings of isolation and oppression. For the second time in the last hour, he found himself forcing back the black veil that circled his vision. He reached out with his hand and lightly touched the shimmering blue light. His fingers met with a soft, smooth substance. "A curtain," he mumbled to no one. "A lousy curtain." He parted the folds and stumbled into a fairyland of gleaming black statuary and blue velvet-covered walls. The huge room was decorated with delicately sculptured fish in ebony stone embedded in a deep indigo carpet. The carpet was unlike anything Pitt had ever seen. It encased his feet to the ankles. He looked up and saw that the entire fantastic setting was reflected in a gigantic mirror which spanned the ceiling from wall to wall. In the center of the room, elevated by four carved leaping sailfish, was a clamshell-shaped bed adorned by the body of a naked girl lying on a sparkling satin spread, her white skin contrasting vividly with the blue and black motif of the chamber. She lay on her back with one knee drawn up and one hand palmed around a small white breast as though caressing it. Her face was enticingly hidden by long, sleek hair that glinted in the light as it trailed across the pillow. The rise and fall of her breathing distinctly showed that her stomach was hard and firm. Pitt leaned unsteadily over the bed and brushed the hair away from her face. His touch awakened her, and she moaned softly. Her eyes slowly opened and locked on Pitt, gazing unseeing for a moment until her sleep-dulled brain registered the sight of the bloody specter standing over her bed. Then her lovely face snapped into shock, and her large, inviting lips opened for a scream that was never uttered. "Hello, Summer," Pitt muttered with a crooked smile. "I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd drop in." Then the door in Pitt's skull slammed shut, and he pitched backward onto the waiting carpet.